And welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey, where you've got me, Becky, along with Justin and Dan in the studio today. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing quite well.
And you, Dan?
I am also well.
I am a little overtired, but enthused and inspired. And to that end, I want to take us back a little bit where we can hear some blasts from the past.
Warning. Made by the team. Hot people.
Squid Ink. It is a lie. For example, the last day.
Hey, kid. Want to buy some squid ink?
Sure. They never saw that kid again. Notice, do not listen to squid ink salesmen. Ever.
That's just a little flavor of going back in time to, two seasons ago of Camp Quest Northwest, where we were doing some all kinds of fun things with snake oil salesmen. I mean, squid ink salesmen, trying to get kids to think critically about what's being told to them and sold to them. And why am I bringing this up today? Well, a few of the folks from the Ask an Atheist crew just spent an entire weekend doing the first ever, the inaugural, the one and only, well, not only, the first of many to come, hopefully, leadership track retreats. We had 21 teens in beautiful North Cascades campground of Camp Waskowitz in Washington. And it's one of the, it's a really cool place. It's a CCC place, the Civilian Conservation Corps facilities from last century, from the previous century. And now it's an outdoor ed school. And we had 21 teenagers doing bonding and leadership games and planning for our Camp Quest Northwest session that will be coming up the first week of July and the third week of August this year. Now, Dan, you're no stranger to Camp Quest.
No. I've been volunteering at Camp Quest since 2013.
So, yeah, one year after Sam and I started volunteering for Camp Quest Northwest. Of course, we're talking about the Northwest chapter of Camp Quest that's been in existence, I believe, now for 25 years. The summer camp beyond belief. The summer camp that is explicitly built on secular humanistic principles and trying to instill an appreciation of nature and critical thinking and scientific reasoning.
And art.
And, yep, and all kinds of things that, you know, sometimes your vision and your mission might be a little bit out of touch with what you actually do. And so one of the coolest activities that we did was having our young people have some prompts and, like, what does Camp Quest Northwest do best? And why do you come here? And how do you explain it to other people who have never been here? And from those, start generating what they believe as the people that are experiencing camp, what they believe to be the mission. What do they think that we're trying to do? And it was a really cool exercise to sort of see what they believe and what they experience and come up with. And so I think we're going to be submitting some of those ideas to the national board, which is opening themselves to hear the suggestions of teens. These are young people who are in 9th through 12th grade, some of whom are soon to graduate high school and graduate into being staff volunteers, volunteer leaders, and counselors. So that was super, super exciting.
That's a really surreal thing as staff on at camp, is seeing campers that were little kids, you know, when you start, kind of like growing up and maturing and sort of like aging into this level where they're ready to become staff members or have become staff members. And all of a sudden they're like totally immersed in this brand new world of like, well, I was a camper and now I'm a staff member. And it's for them, it's sort of like pulling back the curtain, you know?
It definitely had an element this weekend of pulling back the curtain on a few things, of things that were good. Like, hey, what do you think happens, or who do you think are the different like job descriptions of what goes into making a camp session happen? And sometimes them not thinking that, or it doesn't occur to them that, yeah, there's a director, but there's also an assistant director. What does assistant director do? usually takes about half a day midweek when the director finally says, good, lunch is over, wake me up by dinner. And they take their own rest hour, their own extended back on bunk time. And it's cool because the campers, these teenagers will say, I didn't know that that's something that happens at camp. And pulling back the curtain just enough to give them an insight into, well, this is how it works. And how do you want to be a part of it? What kind of leadership skills do you feel like you want and need in order to do the things that you want to do, become more involved in camp?
I really like that idea of putting the curtain back a little bit and having the kids understand the system and how the system works and how this thing all comes together, because it's almost like a primer for civics education.
I can see that a little bit. One of those things that we hear sometimes is, oh, this is like a bubble and it's not the real world. And and then we have to go back to reality. And the prompt and the pushback I give to that is this a lack of reality, or is this aspirational for what reality can and should and might feel like if we work in certain ways to make it happen?
Right. It teaches the concept so that you can understand, like, now that they know how this structure is, maybe there's a curiosity about, like, how does this structure work?
There is never a shortage of curiosity with these teens. And as a teacher, it's one of the things that invigorates me, because, you know, I get my kid fix now that I am in a slightly different role where I'm more of a professional teacher developer. I get my kid fix in, but then, you know, teens will talk to me and say, well, this is nothing like school, or my friends here are more real or more authentic than the kids I go to school with. And it helps me pull back the curtain a little bit on our education system where, hey, if every teacher could have the time to build community in their classroom, to build this kind of safety, to instill this kind of sense of curiosity and keep those affective filters from just like, whoop, you know, going up and preventing you from being engaged, preventing you from feeling safe, being vulnerable in your wonderings and in your curiosity and things like that, we would. But there's so many layers on top of what goes into running a classroom full of 37 people six times a day that makes it really, really difficult to have these kinds of connections from student to student in a way that we don't have those kinds of difficulties from camper to camper, because we have the ability to pause to say, yes, we want to learn content. We want to learn about this particular aspect of science, but we're here to learn about the world and each other and create those connections and understanding in a way that I feel like we don't have time within a regular school system.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Because it's ultimately a scale problem, is it not?
Absolutely. We had 21 teens and 6 adults.
You know, there you go.
And we were able to take, we as adults, as our chaperone leaders, we were able to take, you know, little breaks when we needed it. We said, okay, I need to prep for the next thing, or I'm going to sit back and watch while one or two other adults are leading or facilitating. That's 6 adults to 21 teens, as opposed to when I was a classroom teacher, again, up to 37 young people in a classroom, one adult, six times throughout, you know, six class periods.
Yeah, it almost makes it necessary that you have to maintain order rather than allowing for the kind of freewheeling type of curiosity.
I think that's definitely a challenge, yeah. That tension that we feel.
That's definitely something that I see different from the camp environment or the field trip environment to classroom teaching, that when you're at camp or you're at a field trip, you, and I'm speaking from personal experience, you have the liberty to be like the fun person. Because you're not necessarily the teacher, you know, you are someone who is doing this sort of like extracurricular thing, and this is not a normal like classroom day for them. This is like a special fun thing, and usually they're all happy to be there. But even being like the outsider and going in to teach in a classroom, you still have to sort of like step in and give off this air of like, okay, I'm in charge now, and make sure that it's clear without actually feeling like you're restricting anybody, feeling like you're you know, like restraining their learning ability.
That's a tough line to walk.
The cool thing about this also is that we're equipping young people to be able to or approach or try out walking into a situation where they can be a leader and give off the I'm in charge, but also facilitating the learning and the curiosity and the connection of those that they may for that brief moment of, I don't know, 25 minutes or so be in charge of. Mm. And have those little bits, those little tastes of what it's like to be a leader. Try that out, develop those skills, and then go back to being a camper, right? A young person just enjoying the experience of being in a place and learning. Now, Dan, you're planning on doing something a little bit different this summer with Camp Quest, right?
Yeah. Yeah. My plan this summer is to visit 4 different Camp Quests. So I'll be going to Arizona and Ohio, Michigan, and then back to Washington.
That's quite a sort of different diamond or weird shaped polygon somewhere.
It's a polygon.
It is. And you know, you're so usually embedded in coastal, you know, environmentalism and being a naturalist here in this biome. Between, you know, Ohio, between, you know, the upper Midwest and Arizona, those are really different biomes. What are you going to be hoping to sort of do? What's going to be your thing?
Well, I'm kind of a science guy everywhere I go. And part of what I did when I worked for the Nature Conservancy was study up on the biome that I was going to, so that, you know, even being in this place as a relative amateur, I'd still end up sort of arriving there with more knowledge than the average person, and things that I can share about the flora and fauna that live in those places. So that's kind of on my agenda to study up for this big summer trip. But also I'm going to be assisting the science educators there and doing a lot of sort of shadowing and backgrounding so that, so it's not just me. So I am learning from them and then taking what I learn there and being able to pass it on to others.
Sounds super fun. It's a fun way to spend your summer.
Yeah.
Just getting your kid fix and seeing the world a little bit. Yeah. And seeing how different camps quest attorneys general.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it works like attorneys general.
Passers by. how they do things. You know, all Camp Quests are staffed by volunteers, and so you can go to campquest.org or for us in particular up here, we're still seeking volunteers in our 2 beautiful locations. We've got the coastal Camp Kirby facility we rent from Camp Kirby.
One of the most beautiful places on earth.
It's amazing. It's in the San Juan Islands, as our longtime listeners will have heard and know. And also, so we've got our coastal camp and then our inland riparian North Cascades camp. And I'm really enjoying sort of seeing these different comparisons and just the contrast between both of them. That we're in the same state, yet really different and beautiful kinds of things in both places. Mm-hmm.
That's something I'm very excited about, is going to these different biomes, because I'm a career environmentalist. I mean, this is what I do. And, you know, the Puget Sound, the Salish Sea, the Pacific Northwest, the forests of the Cascades and Olympic Mountains are amazing and important places, but they're not the only places that need protection. They're not the only places where young people especially need to be inspired to protect them.
So we'll be hearing about more young people, I'm certain, inspired and inspiring. But hey, join us in the Northwest. Go to campquestnorthwest.org and you can check it out and see if maybe volunteering a week of your time, either first week of July or third week of August, might be up your alley. Because, well, it's certainly been up mine for the last, like, you know, I don't know, since 2012. This will be
right.
Awesome. Anyway, just one thing that happened this weekend. I'm certain that there was nothing else exciting that's happened this weekend or this week. Nothing else that we'll be talking about after the break. Nope, not one bit.
The devil is not real.
Welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. I lied. There are lots of things that have been happening this weekend, this year, this month, I went a little bit out of order with my time there, but Justin.
Uh-oh.
You're into politics just a little bit.
Oh, you know, I dabble.
Yeah, just a little bit. The dabbling is real, even if the devil isn't. So there are some things, you know, we've had the Iowa caucus, the Nevada primary, and we had something going on this past weekend that caused quite a little bit of a stir and throws lots of red. What was it? It was the Carolina primary, right?
South Carolina primary.
South Carolina primary. We know at this point, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, or former Mayor Pete Buttigieg, has suspended his campaign. We know that Tom Steyer has suspended his campaign, but there's lots of different things that I believe. Am I correct? Or did his campaign just come to a screeching halt after being up on stage with Juvenile singing Back That Tushy Up?
Hey, tomato, tomato. So far, who we have at this moment
tush-mato,
still in the race.
Tush-mato.
People who are still in the race at this moment are Bernie Sanders, Mike Bloomberg, Joe Biden, Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren, and who else? Who did I miss?
Did Yang drop out?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yang dropped out about 2-3 weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
Did you say Bloomberg?
Did I say Bloomberg?
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, you're beginning to see the problem here, aren't you?
Yeah, well, meanwhile, we've got sort of this crazy kind of mix of folks running for the Democratic primary nomination. And at the same time, we've got this history of 4 years ago when there was a crazy mix of Republicans vying for the nomination, ending up with Trump coming to the surface. And we now know, after lots of investigations and reports that have been released, that, well, we definitely did have Russian interference into our electoral process and into our nomination and election process.
Absolutely. Yeah, we've known that ever since. Do you remember the day the Access Hollywood tape dropped?
I don't remember the actual day, but I definitely remember that. This is the one where Access Hollywood caught.
Where Trump was on the bus, the Access Hollywood bus with Billy Bush.
Just glorifying being able to sexually assault women, right?
That same day was the day that Jay Johnson and James Clapper, James Clapper was the director of national intelligence at the time. Jay Johnson, he had another very high level intelligence community job. That was when they first officially released a statement saying that Russia was the target. They were the ones who were doing these hacking, releasing of emails. That was the first public acknowledgement from the United States government that Russia had done it. So we've known since then. And that was October, predated the election.
And in the meantime, we've had, you know, nearly 4 years.
Senate intel, House intel, the Mueller investigation.
And since then, hasn't really gone away too much. We recently had U.S. officials that actually briefed the Sanders campaign somewhere in the order of about a month ago that Russia was aiming to influence the election, perhaps in support of him.
It's a little bit worse than that.
Okay.
So a lot of people in my circle have been focusing on the fact that Sanders was briefed and reacting to that, and that is important to react to.
And Sanders also reacted himself. Yeah. He basically said, you know, message to Russia, stay out of it, stay out of our elections. And
right. Put a pin in that for just a second.
Okay.
So I believe it might have been the last time or the time before the last time I was on Ask an Atheist. We were talking about the impeachment investigation.
Okay.
The impeachment hearings, right? And I had mentioned in the very beginning of my soliloquy on that, that the acting director of national intelligence, Joseph McGuire, had a part to play in that little scenario. Well, a staffer from Joseph McGuire's office at the director of national intelligence, that is the person who briefed the House Intel Committee about what they were also briefing to the White House and what they were also briefing to the Sanders campaign.
Okay.
So this was a multi-agency, interagency process where everybody who needs to know gets the information about what's going on. Now, the Bernie Sanders response to that was to, like, dude, hands off of our elections, basically. I'm paraphrasing.
Dude being, hey, Putin.
Dude Putin, keep your hands out of our elections. The House's response to that was like, follow-up requests for more information. What else can you tell us about how we can better prepare for this? What legislative fixes? So on and so forth. The White House's response to that was to fire the acting director of national intelligence. Yeah.
Nothing suspicious about that.
Nothing suspicious about that at all.
Well, the other thing is that we're hearing Trump kind of dismissing this, saying, oh, yeah, Putin, if you say Putin's trying to help me, meaning Trump, you know, get reelected, that's just a rumor started by Democrats.
Right.
And when I looked at all of the kind of articles and publications around this, this isn't a rumor started by Democrats. These are people within your own administration or within government intelligence agencies. Is he just thinking that anyone that says anything about Putin must be a Democrat?
Yes. So the person
quick to answer that one, Justin,
the person who Trump had put in after getting rid of McGuire. I mean, it's a distinction without a difference whether he resigned or was forced to resign or was outright fired. It doesn't matter. The thing that matters here is person in intel did thing Trump doesn't like. That person gets removed. And then you had a news story a couple of days after the Sanders headline went, that the staffer overstated. They overstated what was going on in this briefing. But that is a statement from the person who is put into this position after the DNI just got removed.
So the cleanup man is
saying that.
It sort of reminds me actually of when Pope Francis would say something that seems really liberal and positive and and novel for Catholic doctrine. And then all these other bishops are like, no. What he really meant is gay folks are still abominations. What he really meant is that atheists are sinners. What he really meant is that dogs aren't actually in heaven. How many times have we covered one of those things?
Exactly. So I will leave everybody to make their own decisions about what the new acting director of national intelligence opinion is worth as far as this intelligence is concerned. However, if you are going to be paying attention to this for any kind of length of time, you might be asking yourself a particular question, like what do Trump and Sanders even remotely have in common that would entice Russian military intelligence to try and continue an operation?
They do kind of say huge the same way.
A bit, yeah. It's at Vermont. We're gonna have Medicare for all. It's going to be huge. So,
Huge.
Speaking as someone who grew up with a father who was from New York, that is definitely a thing. I grew up saying huge and human and humanists and humanism.
Yeah, I was born in Albany. I mean, I know the struggle. So What one of the policy similarities that Trump and Sanders have is, Trump ran on it, but he didn't actually do it, was non-interventionism. Oftentimes you'll hear people on the left talking about like ending illegal wars. You know, hey, maybe let's stop dropping bombs on Palestinian kids, etc. Maybe the Iraq war was a bad idea, stuff like that. So from a policy perspective, that is one of the things that would benefit the Russian government, is if the United States, which is the biggest kid on the block as far as international geopolitics is concerned, would, you know, not. If they would step back from NATO, which is a Trump thing, if they would step back from the UN, which is a Trump and John Bolton thing, if they would focus more on domestic issues, what's going on our own borders, and like leave the rest of the world alone, that benefits Russia, because the Russian government is basically a kleptocracy with Vladimir Putin sitting at the top of it in the official governmental role, and then you've got the oligarchical system around him. The oligarchs are basically just very wealthy captains of industry. Bill Browder was a leading voice on getting the Magnitsky Act passed. And the Magnitsky Act was a series of legislation that would enforce specific sanctions against specific Russians for human rights abuses. I would suggest anyone who wants to know more about that to check out Red Notice by Bill Browder, B-R-O-W-D-E-R. Interest in getting the U.S. to leave them alone is so that they can continue siphoning money out of the Russian government for their own personal bank accounts.
Okay.
That is what they They don't want Interpol to be looking too close. They don't want the UN to pay attention to what they're doing in Crimea, in Georgia, or Chechnya. They don't want the EU establishing solid, reliable economic stability to former satellite states. Cough, cough, Ukraine. That's why they're doing all this at a grand geopolitical scale. It is not because they're communist, because they're not. The USSR fell. Like, that's over. That's over now. I have seen some memes being pushed that are like, oh, for 4 years from Democrats, it's Russia, 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 and now they're trying to nominate a socialist. No.
One, that's not Bernie Sanders there. Is not a socialist. No. Two.
even if he is, at the most generous reading, that's still not the case. That's not how Russia works anymore. Like, we're talking about the fall of the Berlin Wall was November 1989. Okay. And like, that was the fall of Russia. Capitalism then came to Russia. Bill Browder was a capitalist who invested in Russia. And like, I can't recommend this highly enough. Read that book. You'll figure out how the Russian government works. So it's important for people to know that there are going to be people that are trying to mess with your perceptions. The interest that the Russians have, like I said, is chaos. Well, I said the Russian government has, is chaos.
So, and not a particular candidate, one over the other. Candidate. Not saying, Russian interests really want Trump in office, or Russian interests really want Sanders in office.
Right. It may have been the case that there was an element of financial compromise or some other kind of compromise with Trump. It could have just been that he was running as a non-interventionist, isolationist, and the foreign wars pull out a NATO candidate, and that's why they liked it. I mean, you've seen a lot of bot activity around Tulsi Gabbard for similar reasons. I've talked to a friend of the show, Mike Warbington, about this before. Like, it's very interesting that you have a quote-unquote left-wing Democratic House member in Tulsi Gabbard, and then she's getting all these spots and boosted by right-wing media.
Okay.
Weird. What's the deal here? So, if it doesn't pass the smell test, keep smelling and you'll find out what particular thing it is that you're dealing with.
Okay. So in terms of like, why would this be of interest on Ask an Atheist, other than the fact that like the layers and layers and layers are fascinating sometimes to peel back, right? I think that it can come down to, again, that there's a lot of folks that are atheists because they are disillusioned with their religion. There's a lot of folks that are atheists because now they kind of grew up in an atheist household. There are other folks that are atheists because they utilized critical thinking surrounding skepticism, surrounding logic, and looking at where they see logical fallacies when you link causation and correlation when it shouldn't be, when you come to erroneous conclusions, when you start having assertions that are not backed up by evidence, right? Or when you see evidence that directly contravenes certain assertions, then you're like, I don't know if that whole God idea is real. Right. Well, that extends beyond just a belief or disbelief in God, and can come to a belief or a disbelief or a skepticism around any number of claims, including some of the political ones, where no matter how often a demagogue talking head will tweet over and over that something is a conspiracy or a rumor or fake news. Like, dude, at some point you gotta back up that tushy if you're Tom Steyer. But you gotta back up that assertion with some kind of evidence that is actual and tangible, not just an assertion backed by another assertion.
Right. There was, I just recently had an experience myself that the goal here is to apply skepticism to your day-to-day life.
Okay. So you had a moment of applying skepticism to something regarding elections?
Yes. What I saw was a tweet from a person who I did not know. And the tweet was about Jane Sanders having gone on the Russian state-run media channel Russia Today and talking with one of the hosts on that channel about how the Sanders campaign was doing better in open primaries rather than in closed primaries. And because like, oh yeah, she says we'll get Republican voters that are coming over too because they also like his policies. And it's like, reasonable people can disagree about whether or not open primaries encourage or discourage voter participation and whether or not that crosses ideological lines. Reasonable. That the thing that struck me about it is that Jane Sanders was going on Russia Today. Like, does she not know that this is state-run Russian propaganda media? And I had to go to work, so I drove in the car, and I'm sitting there thinking about it, and I'm trying to address the assertion. I'm, like, picking apart the argument a little bit. I'm like, I can see the point. I'm not necessarily sure I fully agree with it, but I can see the point. Then when I finally got the point to work, I checked again. And then I found out that the person who posted the tweet, the video link in the first place, was posting an interview from 2016, a day or two before the South Carolina primary, but it's a 4-year-old video. Mm. And they didn't say that.
Okay.
And the person who was interviewing Jane Sanders died like 2 years ago. There's no way.
It's completely out of historical context.
Completely out of its context. So reasonable people can disagree about the point. But as I was trying to think through this, I'm like, I need to look a little bit further. And then on its face, it was just obvious that it was nonsense, obvious that this was misinformation. And it would have been so easy to say this interview was conducted 4 years ago and actually be honest, but they actively didn't do that.
Hmm. Okay. Any other kinds of experiences where you see like something that we should look out for? Like what is an example of a smell test that, you know, we need to keep smelling behind?
Absolutely. There was a Bernie Sanders. I feel like we're focusing a lot on Bernie Sanders, but this is going to happen to other candidates and in other campaigns. But by way of an example, there's a Bernie Sanders Facebook page. And this fellow that he had joined the Facebook group and made a post where he was, oh, something to the effect of like, oh, I'm so excited for these purges that we're going to have and we're going to bring back the gulag and guillotines on every street corner. And like, there were some comments that were looking at it and like, what? Where? Who are you? And I was curious and I'm like, is this just a wackadoo that just happens to be on my side? So I clicked the profile and I clicked, it was a Facebook profile and I clicked his profile, went to his profile, clicked on see about more info and, went through his likes and it's, you know, 900 likes of Ben Shapiro, our president, Donald J. Trump, the Daily Wire, the Blaze, Turning Point USA, Charlie Kirk, so on and so forth.
Okay, you're giving me a picture of this guy that doesn't seem to be following the, hey, open primaries sometimes get Republicans to come on over.
Right.
This is a guy trying to
This is espionage.
This is a separate guy. This guy was trying to create a post saying, oh yeah, gulags, and then get somebody to agree with him. Because apparently he thinks that's what we are. That's the straw man idea of what Sanders supporters are. And then take that screenshot and then go back to his safe spaces and be like, ha ha, look at these crazy leftists. Whereas what the argument actually is, the argument that say Jane Sanders, for example, was actually making was maybe we can encourage voter participation if we had more open primaries rather than caucuses. The actual argument is very different from the straw man and performative pot stirring that these kind of people can get up to. And I'm not saying that that guy was Russian. I believe he was American. I just believe that he was a jerk.
He's a pot stirrer. So really interesting things to keep an eye out. And I like that. If it smells, keep smelling. Find the source of that smell because, man, things can get wacky. You have been listening and are listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Justin may have some more things after the break. I certainly will. Welcome back. This is a little bit more my style. A little wacky here and there. Because, man, not only has national and international and geopolitical stuff gone wacky, but, you know, things in different states have gone wacky. But, Justin, I saw this moment of, oh, maybe I forgot something or something. Did you have something else?
I did. Alongside the book Red Notice by Bill Browder. That'll give you more insight into the Russian government and how they got to where they are with their country. And it will also tell you the story of Sergei Magnitsky, which I think that everybody should know about. Another resource that I think people could actually get a lot out of and is also really entertaining is a YouTube channel called Innuendo Studios. There's a bunch of different kinds of content on there. The one that I have top of mind specifically is called the Alt-Right Playbook. It's a series of, I want to say, like 13, 15 videos, where the creator goes through, a bunch of different aspects of how the alt-right comports themselves online and some of the tactics that they use in great depth. And I personally got a lot out of it. And I think that if the listeners of Ask an Atheist want to maybe practice or get some more tools in the toolbox of applying skepticism, that might be a good resource to follow up with.
All right. So recommendation for Innuendo Studios?
Yeah, it's called Innuendo Studios.
Okay, neat.
On YouTube.
I don't know the creators behind Innuendo Studios, but I'm always a fan of having more tools in the skepticism toolbox. One of the things that makes me skeptical is when people try and involve themselves in defining how and in what manner folks can get married, especially based on sexual orientation. And for that, I'm going to take us to Iowa. You know, we were just there for caucuses, and now we're going to...
Let's go back. It was fun last time.
Oh, yeah.
It worked out so well.
Well, a state legislator there is floating a bill in the state Senate that would require applicants to list their so-called sexual preferences on marriage applications, which could then be referenced during potentially subsequent divorce proceedings. Applicants would only be granted licenses to marry after choosing from the options of bisexual, heterosexual, homosexual, questioning, unsure, or by specifying an identity not listed. Senate File 2130 would make, quote, fraudulent concealment of sexual orientation grounds for a divorcing individual to lose custody of children. That would only be outweighed by a record of domestic abuse, and that fraud would be more egregious. It would be considered more egregious than jeopardizing a child's safety.
What?
The proposed law, sponsored by Republican Dennis Guth after a constituent was barred from disclosing her husband's homosexuality during marriage dissolution proceedings, has been assigned for subcommittee review with no scheduled hearings as of yet.
What the damn heck is this guy doing? Like, one lady wants to bring up the fact, apparently wants to bring up the fact that her soon-to-be ex-husband, I guess, discovered that he was homosexual at some point during their marriage, and this woman wants to, like, get custody of his kids?
So we need an entire state law to determine.
Right. We gotta set up this whole system of getting into the sticky wicket of sexual orientation and marriage law.
The interesting thing here is that the bill isn't necessarily list your sexual orientation. It says list your sexual preferences. That can get very detailed and very personal very quickly.
I want to know how big this comment section is, because I've got comments.
I'm right there with you. Let's do this.
Yeah. I see a couple of things going on here. And one, all right, so if you're going to have all of these choices and a write in your own option, a person might as well just write in fluid, because that's the psychological truth of the matter, is that your sexual preferences are fluid. Some people, they don't change very much. Some people, they change very dramatically throughout the course of their life. But there's kind of another angle in here that I think is worth discussing, because your fluidity is generally not a choice. So by having this thing, something that you can write down and have, you know, on paper, letter of the law, this is my sexual preference. It sort of implies permanence. And there's almost a slippery slope argument to be made for saying, well, yeah, it's not a choice.
Well, there's a lot of folks that will say, you know, hey, sexuality isn't a choice. I knew since I could remember that I was homosexual, or I was attracted to men, or I was attracted to women, right? And we've spent in a lot of more socially liberal circles a long time saying, you know, this is not just a lifestyle choice that someone can decide, oh, I'm going to live a heteronormative life, because being gay isn't a choice. And at some point, we might be able to step back from that and recognize for some people, it might not feel like a choice and it might not be one. Mm-hmm. You're attracted to who you're attracted to, and that's cool. But for other people, maybe it does feel like more of a choice. And does that make their reality and their way of experiencing human connectedness and sexual attraction any less valid than someone who knew from the age of three that they, a little girl that in preschool dresses up and has fake weddings with another little girl, right? And then grows up to identify as a lesbian and marries another woman and stays in that relationship and, you know, has kids. I don't know that someone that has known that since age three in preschool is going to be more valid than someone who is in a relationship, a young woman who is in a relationship with a man, and then somewhere in her adulthood says, you know what, I'm attracted to a woman, and then discovers a new facet of her sexuality. And so at some point, the slippery slope could be there, but that's only for individuals who feel beholden to hewing to that slope.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. And
why does it need to be a slope? Can't it just be like a flat path that maybe winds a little bit?
Yeah. And regardless of whether or not, you know, it is a set in stone thing from birth that you are one or the other or a mix, or whether it's whether it's something that is fluid, it really doesn't matter. If it's between consenting adults, if nobody is getting harmed, how is this the state's business in any way? And how does it reflect in any way on a person's ability to be a responsible parent?
Gee, and they complain about us virtue signaling. This guy's sending a whole bill. He's sending a whole bill to committee. Like, come on, dude. I just post on Facebook.
Just update your profile a little bit.
Jeez.
So, and I think that the scary thing here is, you know, we know that a lot of the majority, we've posited on Ask an Atheist, the majority of disdain or caution around someone being non-heteronormative, that is, someone under an LGBTQ umbrella, someone identifying as queer, someone identifying as not straight in any particular way, is so much of that is based in religion that prioritizes a male-female dichotomy, a male-female binary, a man-woman binary, and a two people in a marriage binary in our modern context. Of course, look through scripture and you'll see lots of, you know, multi-membered marriages and unions throughout the entire Hebrew scripture,
yes.
Right? But you know, this is religiously based, and we know now that, you know, I mean, I would have no trouble positing and hypothesizing right now that this Mr. Guth, Representative Guth, is coming at this from a religious angle, because we know the Republican Party platforms are inherently religious. And to say that being gay is worse than putting your children in danger, that you are more justified in having your children taken from you because you happen to be gay than because you have a record of neglect towards your children, that's what I see as an abomination. Screw any kind of scripture.
What a goofball.
That, Justin, was horrible.
You're going to be banned. I'm going to write a bill to ban puns, and I'm going to put it in committee, in recurrent discussion in committee.
Look what you've done. I've worked so hard to get the show to accept puns. You come in and ruin it.
Oh, boy.
Well, speaking of committee and state legislatures and acceptance, Washington State's Department of Enterprise Services has granted the Satanic Temple of Washington a permit to perform an infernal ritual on Friday, March 6th. Hey, that's this week. That's this Friday.
Hey.
Outside Olympia's legislative building, the allowance was granted after temple members' request to give an invocation directly to the legislature on any of the 40 calendar sessions lawmakers would be in chambers was rejected. Temple spokesperson Tarkus Claypool,
I know that guy.
Yeah, stated that Satanists were capable of providing an uplifting and meaningful message to state legislators just as well as any other religious group. The congregation invites fellow Satanists and allies of religious pluralism to come join the Unholy Invocation event set to begin at noon on March 6th at the north steps of the legislative building at 416 Sid Snyder Avenue Southwest in Olympia.
I just had one question. Did they deny the
just
permit?
One.
Just one.
Oh, you did need to get your skepticism brain on.
Yeah. did they deny the invocation in front of the legislature just because the Baphomet statue wouldn't fit through the doors? Like, was this a logistical thing?
No, I don't think
that. Do we know that they're haters?
I think we need to do a little bit more fact-finding here. Probably my answer, but we...
Something smells of sulfur. Keep smelling.
No, what we...
The devil's not real.
What we do know is that in order to give an invocation to the legislative body, you have to be invited and sponsored by a legislator. And usually that's someone within your district, you as a constituent, who is a leader of a religious organization or community can say, hey, can I do that? And lots of times it happens. Apparently with the Satanic Temple, it did not happen. We know that there have been non-sectarian, non-religious invocations in the Washington State House because we know that Robert Ray, friend of the show who has been on here, he as a humanist celebrant was invited by a lawmaker to be the person to give that invocation because a humanist community is one that exists even though it is non-theistic. Now, Satanic Temple is also a non-theistic religion. And, well, I don't think anyone was keen, apparently, on giving Satanic Temple audience in chambers. So... you know, apply to a different organization.
In fairness, the Satanic Temple are kind of masters of trolling.
It's kind of really amazing, but at the same time, there's just like humanism is what you do believe, and atheism is what you don't believe. You know, just that what one thing that you don't happen to believe in, which is the existence of God or gods. Satanic Temple also doesn't believe in gods, but gives more things that they do hold of importance. And it's very much in concert with secular humanism, but with different kind of rapping, right? And that trolling sometimes can feel like trolling because of the costumes and because of the theatrics behind it all.
Can't sleep on those costumes.
Right, as Sam called it, dinner theater atheism, right?
Yeah, and in this case, I mean, street theater, public spectacle. And so...
maybe if, with robes and candles and horns and
usually, oh my,
yeah.
So if you're around in Washington State and Olympia this Friday, I mean, I don't know. Tell us how it goes. I'm definitely looking forward to hearing from Lilith Starr, Tarkus Claypool, some of the other key members of Satanic Temple Washington, who how this is going. Because I imagine that once it gets publicity, there might be some counter protesters there.
At the absolute least, it should be a good show.
Yeah, come for the trolling, stay for the religious pluralism.
Yeah, there you go. And the separation of church and state. Yeah. Or the inclusion of all. So there are some folks, though, that despite seeing, you know, Satanic Temple and not really understanding that you don't believe in a literal Satan. That would be Christians that believe in a literal Satan. They just don't believe that Satan's God, right?
Listen, satire is hard.
It is. It is indeed. There seems to be a lot of different mixed perceptions about who believes in what. And I mean, we've probably gotten this, all three of us, as atheists. Probably anyone who's been on this show. What? You're an atheist? But you're so nice. I know that Bridget has gotten that. I got my first one of those, too. Just got my first one of those.
Nobody ever confuses me for nice.
No.
Nobody ever confuses me for not an atheist.
So, but there's some interesting things. I'm going to take us back to politics for a little bit, because Pew did a poll. Let me see. Yes, despite four prominent Democratic presidential candidates professing to be part of a religious tradition, many Americans don't actually perceive them as particularly religious, according to a Pew survey conducted just after the Iowa caucuses in the first part of February. The poll asked about Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren. Now, we know since then, Buttigieg has suspended his campaign, but this was those four frontrunners of the Iowa caucuses. Respondents were actually asked whether they thought each of the four candidates were very religious, somewhat religious, not too religious, or not at all religious, I guess, on that scale. They also had the option to indicate that they were unfamiliar with the candidate or leave the question blank. Despite respondents' perceptions, Buttigieg is actually a church-going Episcopalian who speaks regularly about his faith in campaign speeches. Biden is a Catholic. Warren, who has quoted scripture during debates, is a Methodist who taught Sunday school as a young woman. And Sanders has emphasized that being Jewish has shaped his values. Republicans were overall more likely to see candidates as less religious compared to how Democratic voters perceive their candidates.
That does seem to be kind of the party line with the GOP, is to claim that everything is in the name of Christ. And it seems that there is an awful lot of politicians on that side that want to make you afraid of anybody who is not some form of evangelical Christian.
I, Jesus, think Jesus, that Jesus, it's Jesus, all Jesus.
You sound like my old minister.
Marketing Jesus, campaign Jesus.
You heard it here on Ask an Atheist. But it is interesting where Biden is a Catholic and folks were more likely to see Biden as at least very religious or somewhat religious. And Biden tends to skew more traditional in a lot of ways.
Right.
And so sort of this GOP mindset of, well, if you were Christian or at least religious and of God, you would be Republican, clearly, because we're the party that is religious. Right. If you're not part of us, you must also not be religious. That's not the case necessarily.
No, it's not the case. And like the thing with Democrats is they tend to focus more on policy. Whereas the Republicans have certain types of identity politics things that they really care about. And oh boy, do they really care about them. I have a feeling that's how we get things like this state your sexual orientation thing before.
Remember, sexual preferences.
Excuse me.
You got to have a long comment box, a really open comment box.
Yeah, they really care about that. And I don't think that they care all that much about the policy, really. I mean, I'm generalizing there, but I get that vibe.
I don't know if the policy is able to restrict everyone's practice and being able to uphold your own beliefs to restrict other people's practices of things.
Right.
Like we see that in quote unquote religious freedom bills. I want the religious freedom to discriminate against people that I don't believe should be served in the public square or in have public accommodations. I want the religious freedom to
be
a Christian fascist. I want the religious freedom to not prescribe this birth control to someone, even though my entire job has to do with women's reproductive health. I mean, that's the kind of, so I don't know. I'm going to push back a little bit on that policy stuff, but I really think that it's this correlation and causation that you're assuming that because someone's not part of you, that all other defining characteristics of that person is the exact opposite of all of your characteristics, right? Well, I'm a Washingtonian woman and I have short hair. That means that every Floridian woman must have long hair. I mean, that's like the sensical nature of this. That's the logic that I'm seeing in this.
It's a fair point.
Now,
very fair point.
As a former Floridian, can you confirm that there are actually women in Florida that have short hair?
It is a mountain of hair.
And it's the only mountain Florida's got.
I mean, it varies. varies.
Really? Yeah. Huh.
There's a wide variety of people in Florida.
I'm stumped by that. One more little perception poll. 6 in 10 American voters said that they would consider voting for a well-qualified political candidate who is an atheist, according to the most recent Gallup poll on the subject, where individuals were asked, if your party nominated a generally well-qualified person for president who happened to be and then fill in the characteristic, would you vote for that person? That figure is up only slightly from 2015, but up 15 points since 2007. Two-thirds of Americans now say that they would vote for a well-qualified Muslim candidate or someone under 40. The poll also showed increasing willingness to vote for a candidate who's gay or lesbian and someone who is an evangelical Christian. For more than 90% of Americans, a candidate being either Black, Hispanic, Jewish, Catholic, or female would not impact their willingness to cast a ballot for them if they were otherwise qualified. And socialist candidates would receive support from less than half of those surveyed at only 45%. So socialism is the only thing that will cause less than half Americans to say, yeah, if you're otherwise qualified in every other aspect.
I am glad that the trend line is going towards not having buzzword disqualifications like that. That's undoubtedly a good sign.
What about you, Dan?
It seems like just 10 years ago, it was like this rare and kind of scary thing to be an atheist. And it seemed like I never ran into other atheists. And now it's like, even in regular everyday life, even outside the circle of the listeners to the show and the staff at Camp Quest, I seem to run into more atheists than not atheists. So I kind of like that trend, too.
Maybe you're just getting clumsier.
You are listening to Ask an Atheist. Our music is by Chris Coleman and Phil Whitfield. Thank you so much, Dan and Justin, for joining me. Find out more information at atheist.radio, where you can listen to all of our episodes. It's been a pleasure joining you today. We'll see you guys next week, or maybe March 6th at the Capitol for the Infernal Invocation.